Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Good morning. This is Tracy Hales with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico, and 103.3 in Durango, Colorado. Today, I am again talking with W. Michael Farmer about his new book, The Iliad of Geronimo, A Song of Blood and Fire. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
I want to talk about the new book that I've read of yours, The Iliad of Geronimo, A Song of Blood and Fire. Now, this is a prequel to The Odyssey of Geronimo, right?
Yes, that's right. It covers the last 10 years before Geronimo surrendered to General Miles, and The Odyssey picks up.
Before we go further, I have so many questions, but why don't you give a quick synopsis of The Iliad of Geronimo to our audience?
It begins in 1878 or 77 when John Clum, who was the agent at San Carlos, was directed to take some of his Apache police and go over to Victorio's reservation, which was in the southern mid part of New Mexico at a place called Ojo Caliente, and arrest Geronimo for murders and robberies against the people there in Arizona and New Mexico. Due to a few discombobulations, he actually wound up capturing Geronimo, and it was the only time that he was captured, although General Miles claimed that he had been captured, and that was wound up being a real problem. And so he carried Geronimo back chains with several of his key men to San Carlos, put him in the guardhouse, and told him to just be patient, that soon the Tucson sheriff would come and take him to Tucson and give him the hanging ceremony. As it turned out, and Geronimo swore up and down that he had prayed fervently, and I'm sure that he did, to the Apache creator god, Usun, that he be spared. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Clum quit. The new agent came, and the sheriff never did show up to take him back, and so the new agent let him go. And he was free to camp with people that had not been put in the guardhouse under the leadership of the youngest son, Cochise, who he camped with and became a consigliere for the young son, whose name was Naiche. And as the story spreads out over time, Geronimo was there at San Carlos for right about 8 or 9 months, and he on a drunken binge said something to a nephew that made the nephew hang himself, and Geronimo packed up and left and joined the great war chief, Quo, who lived in Mexico and was chief of the Nedni Apaches. He and Quo had tried to start a reservation, quote, in Mexico. That didn't work out, and eventually General Orlando Wilcox talked them into coming back to San Carlos just about the time that Victorio started his war. And they lived there peacefully for a good while until the Apache prophet, Nok I de Cleni, started the ghost dance. And the Apaches were really high on this prophet until the cavalry tried to put him under arrest because they were scared that he would really stir up a real uprising. And the cavalry just overwhelmed San Carlos. That led the Apaches to break out in mass and go into the mountains in Mexico. 2 years later, General Crook came along, found where they were camped. They were amazed that the Mexicans would let Crook, who used 200 Apache scouts and only 50 cavalry troopers to go into Mexico. And they came back. Crook had worked out a lot of the problems that had made them leave in the first place. And they started building farms at Fort Apache until there was a big foul-up in communications where they were threatening basically to leave because Crook's orders had been that they couldn't beat their wives or make and get drunk on corn beer.
Right.
As it turned out, they were out for about a year when they left there, and eventually told Crook that they would surrender at the Canyon de los Imbutos. Whiskey peddler told them that they would be arrested and hung as soon as they crossed the border. And so they, Geronimo and Aichi and about 40 others, split off from the group that had surrendered, ran wild for about another 5 months before they finally surrendered to General Miles.
Mm-hmm.
And they only surrendered to General Miles because he promised that they would see their families who had been hauled off to Florida. And as it turned out, all of the promises that were made were never really fulfilled. They did get to see their families, but it took about 8 months before that happened. And that's where the Odyssey picks up.
Right. I guess the first question would be, why did you choose to set this up against the Iliad and the Odyssey?
That's a very good question. I felt like that what I have in the two books,
mm-hmm,
is a summary of a truly epic American story.
Mm-hmm.
You won't find it anywhere else. And the comparisons between Geronimo's Iliad and Odyssey and the version that Homer wrote about the Greeks,
mm-hmm,
have some remarkable parallels. Greeks were fighting the Trojans. The Trojans felt like they had an impregnable fortress, Troy. The Apaches, in the same way, thought that they had an impregnable fortress in,
mm-hmm,
the Sierra Madre because they didn't believe that the Americans would ever come across the border after them. And so they had some fearsome warriors, just like the Greeks and the Trojans did. There was Naiche, who was the Chokonin Apache chief. There was Chihuahua, Loco, and you know the list just goes on. And the Americans had their warriors who were men that had nerves of steel, and eventually brought the Apaches to submission.
Right.
And I just saw a lot of parallels, and I wanted to emphasize that this was really a unique and epic story Americans needed to understand.
I agree. And I think that one thing that made this so poignant is that you wrote it in the first-person voice of Geronimo himself.
Yes.
So you really embodied
him. Well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Geronimo was a hard-eyed killer.
Mm-hmm.
He really was.
Yes.
He didn't have any patience. But on the other hand, he lived in a time where it was either kill or be killed.
Right.
And if you got into his tribal and family life, you could see the real humanity in the man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really wanted to capture that and hope that I could give the reader some insight into his humanity.
And I think you've really done that. Geronimo, you know, is reputed to be an evil guy who then changed and submitted. But the way you capture it is that he maintained his strength and fortitude throughout. And like you said, his humanity. You made a real, real true guy. So what made you become interested in Geronimo in the first place?
I had written a trilogy,
mm-hmm.
three novels about a Mescalero Apache named Yellow Boy.
Yellow Boy, right.
I carried Yellow Boy from about 1860 and up until about 1920.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second book of the trilogy, I had him meet and talk with Geronimo when General Crook had gone into the Sierra Madre to bring the Apaches back to San Carlos.
Mm-hmm.
And after I wrote the third book in that trilogy, I went back and decided that I would look a little closer at Geronimo, because there are some really amazing things that he did. He had some kind of supernatural power,
mm-hmm.
that he claimed that Usen had given him to help his people.
Right.
And a good example of that is he had a wife and a couple of his children had been taken by the Mexicans and sold into slavery, and he wanted to get them back. And he had led a group of his best men over into eastern Chihuahua looking for people that they could take as captives that they could trade back.
Mm-hmm.
And one evening he was eating, and he suddenly stopped, and this is described by more than one person who was there. He suddenly stopped and said, in effect, the blue coats have invaded our camps and taken our people prisoner. What shall we do? Well, he was nearly 100 miles away. He could not possibly have known that General Crook was in the area, and yet time after time he was able to foresee events or see events that happened at a long distance.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had this power where he could hold his arms straight out with his palms up, slowly rotate, and he could tell by how warm his palms became the direction that enemy forces were coming. And so I found him just an extraordinary individual.
Mm-hmm.
I don't particularly like him.
Right.
I wouldn't want him as a friend, I don't think. But
right.
At the same time, I have the greatest respect for him. And I really wanted to try to put him out as somebody that was worth a lot more looks and study than he's been given.
Right. I think it's interesting that you were able to not only describe him and did so much research, but you also captured his language and his accent and some of these interesting things he did and how well he was respected by his tribe.
I was lucky in that for most of the times that he was in captivity, he had a man named George Ratton,
mm-hmm.
who did the translation of for him when he had to speak English. He could actually speak and understand English, but he was so afraid that he would make a mispronunciation or garble the words and people would laugh at him. So mm-hmm. he usually insisted on having a translator. And Ratton was probably the best translator around. But the Apaches trusted him to say not only what they had said, but the way in which they had said it.
Right.
A lot of the major things that he had to say, such as when he begged Teddy Roosevelt to be allowed to go back to Arizona, and some of the other things that occurred when he was on the reservations, I think pretty well captured the way that he would speak and think.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what I depended on.
But you did use a lot of other sources too, and I appreciate that you put a bibliography in the back and other sources. So it shows how much research you did. But this is not your original field of study. Your degree is in physics, correct?
Yes, ma'am, it is. I was a physicist, at least a paid physicist, for about 40 years doing atmospheric research.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got connected into the Southwest, because I wound up moving to Las Cruces, New Mexico, and managing a large database that the Army had for aerosols in the atmosphere.
Mm.
And also doing some research at White Sands Missile Range.
Oh, yeah. So while you were in the area, is that when you started getting interested in the Apaches, then thus Geronimo?
Well, it's kind of a long, winding trail, but I've always been interested in Indians. I can remember when I was in the fourth grade reading a book about the Indians in general and the Plains Indians in particular, and just being outraged at how poorly I thought they were treated.
Hmm.
But you know, that kind of went to the wayside as I grew up.
Right.
And had physics books to study.
Right.
And then when I wrote my first novel, which was about the Fountain murders in 1896,
mm-hmm.
and the premise of the first novel was that the little boy Henry survived, and I had to figure out a reasonable way that he could survive, and I decided that he would basically be saved in the winter by an Apache scout who happened to come along at the right place in the right time, and that Apache scout was of course Yellow Boy.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the Yellow Boy story after I did the trilogy on the young Fountain Boy and how he had grown up.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, one thing led to another, but growing up in the 50s and 60s, I was exposed, I think, to some really some really pretty good Western movies.
Oh, yeah.
About the Apaches, and in particular, one that most impressed me, I think, was one called Ozanna's Raid,
mm-hmm.
which just made hash of the real history behind that raid, but it still had some wonderful scenes and actors in it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it really kind of stuck to the cultural history, if you will,
mm-hmm.
of what was going on.
Would you like to read a little bit from the Iliad of Geronimo for us?
I think this is one of the funnier scenes.
Okay.
This is takes place at Fort Apache, and the Apache leaders, including Geronimo, have gathered with their commander, who is a Lieutenant Britton Davis.
Mm.
And Davis is reviewing the rules that General Crook has set down that all the Indians on his reservations had to follow. And two of his rules were the Apaches just could not abide. One was they said that they couldn't beat their wives.
Right.
And the other was that they couldn't make or drink corn beer.
Mm-hmm.
And so during this meeting, Davis is telling the Apaches these rules, and the reaction of one, an old chief named Nane, is kind of funny. It won't make you roll in the floor laughing, but it'll certainly bring a grin to your face, I think.
Okay.
It begins, Teniente Davis. Teniente is the Spanish word for lieutenant.
Okay.
Shook his head and said, Nantan Elpa had good intentions for no tizwin making and drinking. A drunk Indian doesn't know what he's doing. He might kill someone from another band, causing a war between bands on the reservation or even a breakout. You don't think I know, but a drunk Chiricahua not more than a moon ago tried to kill his wife. He stabbed her in the shoulder before others could stop him. Wife beating is not allowed. I had to send a young woman to our Dayen because her husband beat her and broke her arm in two places and left many bruised and bloody places on her. I had her husband put in the calaboose for half a moon for that beating. It's only right that we, Teniente's Davis's talk about the rule against wife beating made Nane so angry. He stood up with a dark scowl on his face, spoke a few words hard to hear in that whispery old man's voice of his, and walked away from the council. All eyes were on him, and men were wondering if they should go too. Mickey Free didn't want to tell Teniente Davis what Nane said, but he insisted on hearing it. Mickey Free squeezed his bad eye shut and said, Nane say, tell Teniente Inchow, which means a stout chief, that he can't advise me how to treat my women. He is only a boy. I killed men before he was born. Teniente made a face like he had eaten some bad meat and was sick. The chiefs nodded their heads and said, We all knew Nane spoke straight words. Chihuahua, still drunk from too much tulipi that the night before, staggered a little as he moved up a step closer to Teniente. He said as he swung his arm toward us, We all drank tulipi last night, all of us in here, those outside and many more except the scouts. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to put us all in the calaboose? You have no jail big enough to hold us all. Teniente crossed his arms and looked at each of us. He said, What to do about this is too serious for me to decide. I was only doing what Nantan Elpa told me to do, which is for your own good. I'll send him a message on the talking wire and ask what to do, and as soon as he tells me, I'll tell you. That was the source of Geronimo's breakout in 1885, because the message that Britton Davis sent to General Crook never got to General Crook, and he had promised the Apaches that as soon as he heard from Crook, he would let them know. Well, no word in 3 days, and they decided that Crook was coming and was going to do really bad things to them. So Geronimo took off, although 70% of the Chiricahuas continued to stay on the reservation, believing that Crook wouldn't really do them any bad harm.
Yeah. He goes, well, I don't think I'm going to wait around to find out.
Yeah.
I want to mention your website, wmichaelfarmer.com, where you have the books and and many, many awards for those books. So what's next?
There's a character in the Iliad named Chaco, who was Geronimo's segundo for a number of years, and then they became bitter enemies. Chaco has really gotten a bad name because Geronimo accused him of being a traitor when he was not, and a liar when he was not. And so I've actually written a duology for that. But the next book that is coming out is called Trini Come. Geronimo's Captivity of Trinidad Verdin, which is about Geronimo taking captive a 12-year-old girl, and she managed to survive with them for a couple of months before they accidentally ran into some Mexican paramilitary, and she managed to escape.
Wow.
And what's fascinating is the only things that we really know about that Geronimo band over those 2 months is what she gave in a couple of interviews, one to the executive officer for Captain Henry Lawton, and one to one of the Mexican authorities that sponsored the paramilitary that helped take her back.
Wow!
But she and you can read these things on JSTOR. She gave two interviews, and they have seemingly conflicting statements in them. Like in one, she claimed that the Apaches beat her up, and in another, she said they barely touched her, you know. So it's really a fascinating story. She got away after her after they had killed her her aunt and the 2-year-old son, and the aunt was pregnant also.
Wow.
On a ranch where she was helping the aunt and her uncle. And I think it's one of the most interesting stories that I've done, and I think I learned more about Geronimo in this story than I did in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
That's a whole different point of view. That's interesting.
Yes, it is.
Like I said, on your website, you've listed them, and there's a lot of them, and I really look forward to the next ones.
Well, I will certainly be sending it to you.
Well, I appreciate
that. It should come out in November.
Okay.
Right.
Good deal. I'll look for that.
Thank you.
And that was W. Michael Farmer, talking about his latest publication, The Iliad of Geronimo, A Song of Blood and Fire. Dr. Farmer talks to us from his home in Virginia and his love of the Southwest and of the stories of Geronimo. This is Tracy Hales with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico, and 103.3 in Durango, Colorado.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.